ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 3rd of February. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. There's been intense speculation the Reserve Bank will hike interest rates today, but some economists believe the central bank will hold off. It comes after higher than expected inflation in the last quarter, putting pressure on the RBA board. Many cash-strapped households will be hoping the rate stays at 3.6%.
It's concerning because my husband's just started a business and it's only been a year since he started it, so we're just breaking even.
We were promised a few years ago that rates were going to come down and they seem to be going up again, so it's a bit disappointing, to be honest. So it comes down to us, me and my partner, having to work extra shifts, find money from other places.
For more on this, Diana Messina is the Deputy Chief Economist at AMP. Diana, thanks very much for your time on AM this morning. Economists seem to be in agreement that a rate hike today is all but certain. Is there any chance that doesn't happen?
Good morning. I mean, there's always a chance that we get a surprise from the central bank, and we have seen that before. I mean, the markets are pricing in about a 70% chance of a hike today. There are a few economists, including ourselves actually, who think that the decision could go towards a hold. I mean, it's a really close call. I'd say it's more like a 50-50 chance whether they hike or they hold. There are basically a number of reasons that could take it either way, and I think you can argue for a hike or a hold quite easily. But the main reason for why we see the decision perhaps being more towards a hold is that we think the Reserve Bank will read the latest inflation data as showing that the momentum in inflation in December actually looked better than they feared. And I think that that's what's key when they're thinking about their inflation forecast ahead.
And many Australians probably felt like this cycle of rising inflation was over. They were maybe surprised to see those figures in the December quarter. And then to be in this position, potentially staring down more rate hikes. What happened?
I know it can seem a bit confusing, I guess, because you know, we've obviously been in this period of very high inflation in 2022 where prices were 7-8%, and then this period where prices have come down, but I think people are still feeling like inflation has still been a problem because we've had this big level change in prices. So yes, the pace of growth has been good, but when you go shopping and just buy basics like groceries, or when you get your bills, things just seem expensive. But it's the pace of growth that we're targeting here, not the level of prices. The level of prices has just shot through the roof across all advanced economies since COVID. I mean, I don't think that we've necessarily it's not like we're off track with inflation. It's just that it's a bit higher than we'd like it to be. The Reserve Bank targets inflation between 2 to 3% and they want it to be 2.5%, but it's running at a bit over 3% basically. So it's not like it's completely derailed. Inflation is running at 7, 8% again like it was during COVID. It's just that it's not within the central bank's target.
And if the RBA board do decide to hold at this meeting, what's the likelihood this is the beginning of a pattern of rate hikes for the year ahead?
And that's a possibility. We don't think that that's the most likely outcome, though. And the reason is that we think inflation's going to soften from here. We don't see it continuing to rise. So if we were wrong and we're actually in for higher inflation prints ahead, then we could see a series of rate hikes. But our view on inflation is that we're going to get back within the target band between 2 to 3% growth in inflation by the end of the year. And the reason for that is because when you look at forward-looking business surveys and they give us indicators about what they think is going to happen to prices, they're still pointing down. Wages growth has softened as well, and that should lead to softer inflation. And government spending has peaked, and the growth of government spending is going to add less to inflation compared to where it has been. So I think all signs point down to inflation rather than up, and that makes me confident that we're not in for a series of rate hikes. I mean, if we're wrong on that forecast and, you know, we see renewed pressures in services or goods prices, then that's a different story. But I'm just not seeing those upside inflation risks in those areas right now.
Deanna, thanks for your time on AM this morning.
Thank you, Isabella.
And Deanna is the Deputy Chief Economist at AMP. Despite peace talks, the coalition remains divided for the return of federal parliament today. Nationals leader David Littleproud and Liberals leader Susan Lee met last night to discuss a potential truce. But sticking points remain. The ongoing split will hamper the opposition's ability to hold the government to account today. Political reporter Sarah Tomevska has more.
As politicians flock back to Canberra for the return of Parliament, the question everyone's asking is whether the coalition will reunite and under what conditions.
We are better together and we're stronger together, but that doesn't come at all costs.
Liberal Senator Maria Kovacic says there are clear red lines for her party room and the leader, Susan Lee.
Shadow Cabinet solidarity is a baseline mandatory necessity. There's no question about that. And breaches of that do have consequences.
Backing in Susan Lee's decision to accept the resignation of three National senators who breached that solidarity by voting against hate speech legislation a fortnight ago.
Our leader Susan Lee has been very patient. She's been very reasonable and her door has been open the entire time for a conversation with the Nationals and their leader, David Littleproud.
That meeting took place last night where the parties agreed to keep talking. Deputy Nationals leader Kevin Hogan was in the room and says reunion could require the coalition agreement to be rewritten to allow more dissenting views.
Certainly moving forward now, how cabinet solidarity, shadow cabinet solidarity would work was very thoroughly discussed.
Susan Lee has given the Nationals till Sunday to reunite or miss out on shadow cabinet roles for good, as the Nationals demand their three senators be reinstated in the shadow ministry.
Obviously that is one of the elephants in the room. They have put some ideas to us. We responded to that. We're going to take some of those ideas to our party room too so that we can agree with some of the guardrails of how they want it to operate going forward.
In the meantime, the coalition continues to hemorrhage support to One Nation, with a Redbridge poll on Monday suggesting Pauline Hanson's primary vote has jumped to 26%. Cos Samaras is a pollster at Redbridge. He says the damage could be baked in.
It's going to be pretty hard. They have to ruthlessly adhere to a policy offering that gives people hope that they are going to represent them economically.
All while the Liberal Party leadership remains in question, with Susan Lee expected to face a challenge from leading Conservative Angus Taylor this week or next. Here's Maria Kovacic again.
Angus Taylor is a member of the Shadow Cabinet. I think that if he were intending to move a spill, that he would have resigned that position. I don't see him doing that whilst he's still a member of Shadow Cabinet.
With the coalition's peace talks unlikely to be resolved before question time today, Leader of the House Tony Burke has told the ABC arrangements will be changed to reflect the new numbers, given the crossbench is now as big as the Liberal-only opposition, meaning less questions for the opposition and less opportunity to hold the government to account.
Sarah Tomevska reporting there. Disability advocates say there's been an outpouring of grief, sadness and anger over a suspected murder-suicide in Perth. Police believe two teenage boys who lived with disabilities were killed by their parents last week before they took their own lives. Isabel Masali reports.
On Friday morning, police were called to a home in the Perth suburb of Mosman Park. What they found inside was described as highly distressing to all. The bodies of 14-year-old Otis, 16-year-old Leon, and their parents, Jared and Mai Clune. It's being treated as a suspected double murder-suicide.
This is a horrible tragedy, and I want to express my condolences to the family and friends.
Rosemary Kayes is the Disability Discrimination Commissioner.
And secondly, the fact that the children may have been autistic and required supports should not be the basis for any justification of their murder. we've seen this play out in similar situations where the narrative has been about the burden of disability on parents and families, as in some way to downplay the murder of two children.
Police say a note was found at the home, and while an investigation is still underway, public attention has turned to the family circumstances. WA Premier Roger Cook.
Our heart goes out to the entire community impacted by this apparent murder-suicide. It's horrible. It's unbelievably horrible. Obviously, we'll do everything we can to provide the answers to the community. So I understand there's speculation around NDIS support, schooling support and things of that nature. I just invite everyone to please be patient.
Skye Kokoski-Moore also wants a thorough investigation. She's the CEO of Children and Young People with Disability Australia.
There's been understandably an outpouring of grief and sadness and anger in the community. Children and young people with disability deserve to live in a society where they feel safe, where the systems that are designed around them are designed with them.
But she warns some reporting and commentary has been harmful.
It's really important that we take every opportunity to affirm that children with disability are not a burden. Often the framing is that their lives have been very difficult for others to manage, but what's most important is that their lives have value and that their reporting of their death recognise them as human beings and afford them that dignity that they deserve.
It's yet to be confirmed if a coronial inquest will be held. Commissioner Rosemary Case supports one and hopes it would lead to more recommendations implemented from the Disability Royal Commission.
They concluded that people with disability in Australia had been systemically devalued, and we need to be concerned and committed to action in this area to be able to build a much more cohesive community where people with disability are valued as, you know, equally participating members of the community.
In a statement, NDIS Minister Jenny McAllister said her heart goes out to the family and the community. She added the National Disability Insurance Agency will provide support to WA authorities in the ongoing investigation.
Isabel Misali reporting, and if you or anyone you know need help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. The Australian government says its Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme is a win-win, but a new report has found many shortfalls. The program employs more than 30,000 workers from the Pacific and Timor-Leste to fill jobs in regional Australia, but some have been found to deal with exploitation and a lack of basic rights. Lucy Cooper has more.
From his work on a farm in southwestern New South Wales, Gabriel Palmer has been able to pay for his five children to go to school, set up a small business, and build a house for his family and parents back home in the Solomon Islands.
It's amazing because I was really improve my family. When I come back here, I send money to my children, my wife, and help my sibling. So this is a great thing for me as well.
Employed under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme, also known as the PALM Scheme, Gabriel Palmer first came to work in Griffith in 2020. His employer, Jonathan Moss, is a wholesale nursery grower based in the New South Wales Riverina town.
When you're dealing with a live product that needs to be picked or packed or worked on today, not tomorrow, not yesterday, you need reliability. And that's what the PALM scheme has created for us as a company.
90% of Mr. Moss's employees are from the PALM scheme.
It's a brilliant scheme because it works both ways. You know, we have skilled, dedicated workers and employees, and then we obviously pay them the Australian award wage, and they take that money back, which is severely multiplied, and it changes their lives.
The scheme is the focus of a new report released today titled Improving PALM. Its author is Peter Mayers.
It's important to see this as a form of cooperation between Australia and the Pacific, not as Australia somehow bestowing some great benefit on the Pacific.
An independent researcher and writer, Mr. Mayers was commissioned by the Scanlan Foundation Research Institute. After several months of research and interviewing employees, employers, country liaison officers, volunteers, unions, academics and researchers, he's made 10 recommendations to the government to improve the scheme.
I think the most important reform is to give farm workers themselves greater agency, and that means to give them a greater right, to make it easier for farm workers to change jobs within Australia.
Palm visas tie a worker to their approved employer, which Mr. Mayers says leaves workers with very few choices if they're ill-treated or underpaid. If they speak up, they fear that they may be sacked and sent home. Improving health outcomes for workers is also a key recommendation.
One of the other things that concerns me about the Palm scheme is the fact that palm workers don't have access to Medicare.
Mr. Mayers says the scheme is a triple win for workers' incomes and remittances, for regional employers, and amidst a strategic rivalry with China, a win for Australia's Pacific relationships.
I didn't speak to anyone deeply engaged in the scheme who thought it was a bad idea. I didn't speak to anyone who wanted to scrap the scheme, but a lot of people think it can be improved. And the key issues are around the exploitation of workers by some employers.
For Solomon Islander Gabrielle Palmer, he's happy to take skills from the nursery back home.
I learned some skill here that if I go back to my community, then I will try to doing that skill, apply that skills to the community. Maybe the community will benefit as well.
Palm scheme worker Gabrielle Palmer ending that report by Lucy Cooper and AM Approach, the Pacific Island Affairs and Workplace Relations Minister, for an interview. It's the coldest, driest, and windiest continent on Earth, so Antarctica truly can be a dangerous place to live and work. To keep Australian expeditioners safe on the ice, survival specialists are required. Reporter Jano Gibson went on a trip supported by the Australian Antarctic Program and met two members of the expert team.
Near the Swain Islands in East Antarctica, a group of expeditioners is heading to a remote penguin colony led by field training officer Arno Payan.
We can safely and efficiently take people out into this incredible environment, which is beautiful but can be extremely dangerous as well.
To reach the penguins, the expeditioners have to cross a 2 kilometre stretch of sea ice, a potentially hazardous activity during the warmer summer months.
If you're not careful, you could just walk on bad ice or thin ice and fall through.
To ensure the ice is safe to walk on, a special drill is used to test its thickness.
We have 50 centimetres of really good ice, probably more like 60 centimetres.
That's more than enough to carry the weight of the group. But as an extra precaution, Arno Payan provides some additional training.
What we're going to cover is just if the worst were to happen and someone were to fall through.
First, there's a demonstration of how to rescue someone with a rope if the ice gives way.
Arno, catch this rope!
And then he explains how to use an ice axe to haul out of the water.
If you were to fall through the ice, you're going to use that axe to just pretty much claw your way out.
Antarctica's challenging conditions have resulted in fatal accidents and injuries over many decades. To reduce the risk, field training officers are stationed at each of Australia's Antarctic facilities. Kate Tucker is one of the survival specialists at Casey Station.
So search and rescue is our first tenant. Our second one is to provide field support for our scientists when they're out in the field. So when they do their field work, we accompany them and help them to be able to live out here safely.
Field training officers also teach critical survival skills to all new expeditioners, including how to rescue people from crevasses and how to build snow shelters if they get caught in a blizzard.
It is the true land of extremes. It can be like we're out here today and it's windy and it's biting cold, but it's pretty lovely. You know, it's probably 10 knots of wind, but out here, you know, we've had over 100 knot winds in the winter.
She says Antarctica's unpredictable and hazardous environment needs to be treated with respect.
It is about mitigating the risks, but the risks are worth us being here to understand this place. This is what we need to do, to understand it so we can value it and we can protect it.
Field Training Officer Kate Tucker ending that report by Jano Gibson. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. There are 3 million pages and thousands of mentions of Donald Trump, but the US president says the latest batch of the Epstein files clear him. Today, David Smith from the United States Studies Center at Sydney Uni on the millions of documents still hidden. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.